This podcast includes information provided by the issuer and does not express the views of the interviewer. This podcast may also include forward-looking statements by the issuer that involve certain risks and uncertainties to its business. Because forward-looking statements are subject to risks and uncertainties, the issuer's actual results could differ from those indicated in this podcast. Welcome to the Planet Microcap Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Kraft, and thank you all so much for the support and for tuning in to the Planet Microcap Podcast. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at Bobby K. Kraft. That's B-O-B-B-Y-K-K-R-A-F-T. And you are listening to episode 23. For this episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, I spoke with Donald Porter, Senior Vice President at DGHM & Co. I met Donald a couple months ago, and we were talking about how his firm was working on a white paper talking about microcap stocks. I followed up with him, and he sent it over. The white paper is titled Microcaps Value Uncovered, and I thought, rather than dissecting the paper myself, why not invite Donald onto the podcast to explain the firm's thesis? And furthermore, as the first line of the thesis states, and I quote, "The world of microcap stocks is an exciting, vast, and rich place to allocate capital," end quote. That got my attention, and I wanted to hear more. So here we go. The goal for this episode is to learn about the opportunities when investing in microcap stocks, according to DGHM & Co. What makes microcap stocks interesting today relative to other asset classes, and an understanding of microcap stocks as compared to large caps. Thank you again for tuning in to episode 23 of the Planet Microcap Podcast. Please enjoy my interview with Donald Porter, but first, a word from our sponsor.
A comprehensive streaming of market data, research, and portfolio management application for you. QuoteStream is a real-time streaming quotes and research system designed for the day trader, retail investor, institutional investor, both new and old. QuoteStream offers low latency, tick-by-tick data, advanced charting, comprehensive technical analysis, news, and research. With no software to install and no servers to maintain, QuoteStream is the ideal solution for you. Go to stocknewsnow.com and start your free 7-day trial. Click the QuoteStream banner in the header or real-time quotes in the nav bar to get started building and managing your investments.
For this episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, I have Donald Porter, Senior Vice President at DGHM & Co. on the program. Donald, welcome to the Planet Microcap Podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. So DGHM recently put out a white paper titled Microcaps Value Uncovered. But first, before we get into that paper, which we're going to be dissecting in this interview, I wanted to start off with your background and how were you introduced to investing in microcap stocks?
Sure. So I joined Dun & Grinder about 10 years ago. We're a 30-year-old firm. We manage about $2 billion. And I joined, again, about 10 years ago. And I'm a sector specialist here. So I cover industrials and services. I'm one of nine sector specialists. And I work on a variety of portfolios. We've had a dedicated microcap portfolio since 1990. And we also have a small cap portfolio, a mid cap, an all cap, and an equity long short hedge fund. So I was introduced to microcaps very early on. It's definitely a big focus of the firm, and it's an area that I've had a lot of fun with because you really can, you know, get to know these companies in a very intimate way.
Okay, so as I started off in this interview, DGHM did recently put out this white paper. Again, it's titled Microcaps Value Uncovered. And I think you kind of went over it in the opening there, but what I want to know is, what was the motivation to write this paper?
The motivation to write it was that I recently became the team leader of Microcap, and we recently launched a mutual fund. So we wanted to dig in and really understand, you know, the returns of microcap investing over a very long period of time, 90 years, look at the Fama French data, and kind of explore it, and see, you know, does microcap really outperform, and then if so, why? And that was really the premise of the paper. And I can kind of go into, you know, what happened, and what we found was basically that the Fama French data supports the fact that microcaps do outperform over the long run, and really, if you couple it with value, in a value overlay, it dramatically outperforms. So micro value has produced a 16% 10% annualized return over the past 90 years. And if you compare that to micro growth, it's returned about 2%. So I found that to be a very, you know, a powerful statistic, and something I didn't quite realize. I didn't quite realize it was that dramatic over that period of time.
It's funny. You're stealing my question number four right now. No, I'm just kidding. But I will actually be asking more about that in a second. But first, to get right into the white paper, as you just did, you know, because it does provide a great overview about the opportunities when looking at investing in microcap stocks. So to start off, according to the paper, why do microcaps beat large caps over the long term?
I think our view is that they're less efficient, and the best statistic to look there is that 30% of microcaps have no sell side coverage. On average, they have about 2 sell side coverage for a small cap, which has 4, and large cap has about 11.
So what is, real quick, for our audience that may not know what that means, what is sell side coverage?
So sell side coverage is any big bank or small bank, like a Morgan Stanley or a Merrill Lynch. They have analysts that cover certain, you know, stocks by sector usually. And so if you think about a large cap name like Boeing, there's probably 30 analysts on, you know, at varying brokerage firms like Merrill Lynch that are publishing research about what they think the stock is going to do, and they put out estimates, earnings estimates of what they think the company will do in the future. And as you work your way down to smaller cap stocks that don't pay big investment banking fees, you find, oddly, that a lot of brokerage firms aren't there.
I wonder, in your research, did you kind of figure out why, or is it just like a, we don't do it?
I think the larger firms in general, you know, this is a business for them. From a, you know, Morgan Stanley, if it covers Boeing, is going to trade a lot of the Boeing stock, and that's how Morgan Stanley makes money. And they're also going to do investment banking work with Boeing. But if you have a very small company that trades 5,000 shares a day, the commissions really aren't there to justify covering. And so what you tend to find are regional brokerage firms like Stevens and BB&T and William Blair will cover some of the smaller companies out there, if they're covered at all.
Okay, so to finish up your answer, so again, why do microcaps beat large caps over the long term?
Yeah, so I'd say the inefficiency is a big part of it. I would say that there is a liquidity risk premium, so there is higher volatility when you invest in microcaps. You need a longer time horizon. If your time horizon is 10 years, it actually is a pretty interesting place to be, because you can withstand that volatility. So it's liquidity, it's inefficiency, and then there's also a variety of smaller reasons. You know, microcaps tend to be takeout targets. 60% of takeouts tend to be in the microcap space. They have higher insider ownership. On average, a microcap stock has 10% insider ownership versus 4% for small caps versus, I think, 0.4% for large caps. They are also more exposed to the domestic economy, which has been stronger recently. So there are a variety of reasons. Now, on the flip side, there's also a lot of companies out there that are not that great in microcap. And so I think it's important to, if you're looking at the space, you really got to do your homework, because there's a lot of names and a lot of them aren't that great.
Okay, so all right, getting back to a point that you brought up earlier about the difference between value and growth, and you covered this in the paper. So what is that difference, and then why is this important to understand?
Well, I always had known or had heard that value beats growth over time. I didn't know it was so dramatic. My rationale on that is that a lot of these growth stocks, which tend to have very optimistic views, tend to attract a lot of capital, and then those views never really come to reality, and those stocks end up underperforming a lot. So a value tilt, I was always aware value tilt helped. I didn't know it was so dramatic in microcaps, because if you look at large caps, the spread between value and growth is still there. Like, value beats growth in large caps, but it's a much smaller spread. In micro, though, value is a much stronger indicator of outperformance than large caps. So I don't exactly know why it's so much more in microcaps, but it tends to be a very strong factor.
So what exactly is it, though? Like, what do you mean when you say, because I'm guessing value microcap stock versus a growth microcap stock.
What we're looking at, and what the Fama French data is looking at specifically, is price to book. That is the metric they're using to define something that is value. we tend to look at, especially for industrials, we would look more at an EV to EBITDA or a free cash flow yield kind of metric to find the valuation of a stock.
And this is basically important because as you're formulating your strategy about how you're going to start investing potentially in microcaps, this is something that you'd want to keep in mind, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the paper even goes further in that it talks also about quality versus junk. Mm-hmm. And the Luthold Group puts out a nice data on this going back to the early 80s. And it shows that quality companies, high return on capital type companies tend to outperform junk. And these are broad statements in that they don't always happen. Sometimes growth outperforms value. Sometimes junk outperforms quality. But over the long run, those trends are valuable and work. So if you can construct a portfolio that is smaller cap, micro cap, value tilted and quality tilted, you have a massive advantage statistically over everything else.
So in the paper, it also states, and I quote, "passive investment in microcaps has not been successful," end quote. So I firstly want to know why, and then would the opposite argument then be that aggressive investment is more in microcaps is more successful?
Yeah. So when we took a look at ETFs that exist in microcap, they have very high tracking error, and they don't really mimic the index that they're supposed to mimic. And the big reason for that is liquidity cost. Getting in and out of a microcap stock costs a lot. It can move the stock a lot, so you have to be patient about building positions. And so an ETF really just isn't set up to do that. The second thing, and this is sort of why we think active management is more appropriate, is that in microcap investing, you have lots of stocks. You have maybe thousands of stocks, and there's a lot of companies in there that aren't that great. And so a portfolio manager can add a lot of value by picking the winners and picking the higher quality names and maybe the more liquid names, as opposed to buying a basket of all the names where you're getting some really good companies but also some really bad companies. So we think this space is ripe for active management given its inefficiency and given the dispersion of companies that exist in the space.
And by active management, you mean you find a company, you call up you obviously do your quantitative and qualitative research, and then you calling up management, you're speaking with them with your questions and concerns, and then going in and potentially taking position. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, active management would just mean a professional like firm, like a fund. Oh, so, like what we do, we have a microcap fund that is trying to beat the benchmark. And so if you're an investor looking to invest in a fund, you have the option to go into an ETF or into a passive vehicle that's just trying to beat the microcap market, or you can try to bet on a manager to try to beat that benchmark. And it tends to be that managers have had a good ability to beat the benchmark in microcaps, and so that's what I'm referring to.
Okay. And just to clarify, what is that benchmark that most managers use?
A lot of managers use the Russell Microcap. We use the Russell Microcap Value. You can also use the Russell 2000 as well, but the Russell Microcap tends to be the more specific benchmark used.
Okay, so for my audience out there, these are some of the indices that you can use to, if you're already starting to develop your own portfolio of microcaps, that you can judge your own portfolio against to see if you happen to be beating it or if you're losing or if you're right in line. So you actually brought up another point that's very interesting, and that has to do with liquidity. And in the paper, you talk about this liquidity risk premium as a driving factor for microcap performance. Can you explain why?
Yeah, so simply put, a lot of microcap stocks, especially as you get down into lower cap spectrums, just don't trade a whole lot. And so if you're a very small investor, usually that's not it doesn't impact you in a significant way. But let's say, our portfolio, for example, is $100 million. Our microcap portfolio is $100 million. So when we want to invest in a company, we're typically taking a $1 million position. So, if it trades 5,000 shares a day, and maybe that equates to, $50,000 in dollars per day, that's going to take us a really long time to get into if we only want to be 10% or 20% of the float each day. So we have to be very mindful of that. And we probably would not want to get into a name where it's going to take 100 days to get into, because that if we want to get out, we might not be able to. So we're very cognizant of that. And now a smaller investor can probably get in and out a little easier because their position size is a bit smaller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just going to say, as an institutional investor, while you know liquidity and illiquidity is an issue, I mean, if it's a good business, you just have to really love the business. I mean, is that kind of what you're saying also?
I just think that, you know, people, it's like, you know, why do people get compensated for going into buying a house? A house is very illiquid, so you would think that you would need to get a higher return in order to take that higher risk. And so I think the same logic applies to a microcap stock. Because it's less liquid, you should earn a higher return because you're taking more risk. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what that's about.
That's I like that parallel. That's very interesting, actually.
Yeah.
So yeah. What are some of the other characteristics that make microcap investing attractive, according to the paper?
Yeah, so I think I talked about a few, which would be higher insider ownership, less analyst coverage, higher domestic exposure, more targeted for M&A activity. Because they're smaller, you know, small changes can have bigger impacts. If a company announces a restructuring, you know, if they remove $1 million of cost, that could be a very powerful thing for the company. If they acquire a smaller company, that could have an outsized impact on the results. So, you know, that would be another factor. I think just on a personal level, you know, having done this for a decade, it's a more, I think, rewarding experience to be able to talk to a company and develop a relationship with a company than it is with a larger stock, where you're typically dealing with an investor relations team. You're not really talking to the people that are actually making the decisions. So I think that, to me, is probably the more exciting part of it, especially if you're doing it on your own. That's what I'd say about that.
Well, I wanted to follow up about the one point about insider ownership. You know, like in your opinion, what's like the ideal percentage that an executive should own in the company make you feel comfortable?
I think it really depends on the size of the company. We tend to not. So the other extreme of this is where a family owns a lot of the company, and sometimes they have dual share classes, which give them super voting rights. So they may only own 10% of the economic interest, but they might own 60% of the voting interest and therefore control it. And we tend to not like that because it usually leads to nepotism and the inability to be acquired. And it's just far more difficult for outside shareholders to exert influence. So I tend to like a company where the insider ownership is not so high that it limits the float and it limits the ability to affect change from maybe an activist or something like that. So we like to see it high, but if it's really high because of some family issues, that might be a negative.
So I also found this one section that was particularly interesting, and that was comparing microcap versus private equity. So what I was curious is why is there parallels and what is the fundamental difference when owning a microcap stock versus shares in a private company in one's portfolio?
Well, we make the comparison because if an institution, and this was maybe more geared for like an institution, if they're thinking about where to put their capital, they most institutions have a bucket for private equity. And our point here was that microcaps as an asset class can provide probably a very similar return with far more liquidity than a private equity investment, which it ties up your money for, you know, sometimes 10 years, with far lower fees and similar risk profiles. So that was the initial idea behind why we would compare microcaps to private equity. We think there are a lot of similarities, but they are very different from the standpoint that, and you know, if you invested in our fund, we have a mutual fund, so you can literally go in and out every day if you really wanted to. Where a private equity investment is really for the province of big institutions or high net worth individuals, and you're locking your capital up for a very long time, and they're taking massive fees from you, and you know the return metrics and how they actually mark to market their portfolio companies is varies. And so the actual returns that are reported in private equity are probably overstated, and the volatilities are probably understated. And I can get more into that, but basically I think there's a lot of pitfalls with the private equity universe as we see it today, and therefore we think microcaps make an interesting alternative to an investment in private equity.
Well, what would your opinion be? Like, for instance, there's a lot less IPOs happening. There's a lot less new names coming into microcaps. You know, so there's the argument that there is still, there's a lot of quality, but it happens to still be in the private sector and it's just not going public. So what would you say to that?
I think that is a headwind, actually. We've seen a lot in this environment of very low rates. You see a lot of M&A activity, which takes companies out of the market. And we haven't seen as much IPO issuance in the microcap market. I think it's very true. And I think it's a function of regulation, and that if you want to be a publicly traded company, it's very expensive and you're under the gun to some extent. And so I think that's probably more relevant for venture capital, where I'm a firm starting out and the venture capital firm owns me, and instead of going public, I'm just going to stay in this kind of structure. So I think venture capital, we don't make a direct comparison really to that, because I think that is a very different type of investing. We're more referring to the private equity where you're buying a legacy company, a company that's been around, it's mature, and it's really a change of ownership.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I see. It was just, I wanted to clarify that difference because it just, you know, it was funny. I actually started thinking about your comparison when you said an illiquid microcap stock is like owning a house, because it's not an illiquid. You know, it's like, oh, it's kind of very similar to when you're buying shares in a private company. You know, you're that's really illiquid as well.
It's very illiquid, exactly. And you know, the hard part about a private company, if you think about it, is well, you know, to buy it, you have to get permission from the owner. You have to go in there and talk to him. You don't have all the information at your disposal. There's no 10K or Q to read. There's no audited necessarily financial statements. You have to really be almost an investigator. And you don't know which companies are for sale and which aren't. So it's a much, for an individual retail investor, the beauty of the stock market is that, you know, these stocks are always open for business. You can always own a piece of them. Where a private company is a much more, you know, intense due diligence process to understand who's available and what actually is under the covers of that company.
Okay. So I want to ask, what makes microcap stocks interesting today relative to other asset classes?
Well, microcaps tend to be cheaper than large caps over time, but that spread is wider now. And so, you know, we make the case that, you know, on average, microcaps on a price-to-book basis averaged about, 1.2 times a price-to-book, and now the spread is 1.9 times. So microcaps look cheap relative to large caps based on history, and they've also underperformed large caps as well. So we make the case that they look cheaper than large caps on a historical basis, and they've also lagged large cap stocks. And so maybe this is an interesting time to be in the space because they look cheap and they've underperformed, and so maybe that inflects and changes.
Well, why is that important to consider? You know, if they've lagged, why is that an indicator for you that this is now becoming interesting?
Well, they tend to, if you look back to 1936, you look at the data, they tend to outperform and underperform, and it's cyclical. So they could continue to underperform. There's always that risk, but I'd rather own them when they're below, when they've underperformed for, you know, 5 or 6 years, because I think these things run in, you know, 7-8 year cycles. So at some point they're going to outperform again, and I'd rather catch it, you know, it's going to happen within the next few years. It may not be this year, but it'll happen. So I think it is important to consider. It's something to look at. I mean, it's very hard to know. These things run in very long cycles, so it's very hard to predict, but it's something, you know, I think you should be cognizant about.
Okay, so I like that. Okay, so there's a cyclical nature, not just for individual sectors, but there's also a cyclical nature when you're talking about microcaps as a whole, basically.
Exactly, yep.
Okay. So, all right, before I get into the summary of what we should take away from the white paper, I ask this to all my guests. You know, what can you draw on an experience that you learned the most from in your microcap investing career?
Yeah, it was probably a mistake. there was one stock that I always go back to. Everyone asks me, what was a big mistake? And it was definitely a mistake. It was early on in my career. I had picked up the transport sector. And so a lot of names in there that are small caps are trucking companies. Mm-hmm. And there was one called USA Truck, ticker USAK. I think it's still around. And
full disclosure, are you still currently a shareholder? But
I am not a shareholder. I got out of that one a long time ago. Thankfully, got out of that one a long time ago. And, you know, at the time, they were basically a break-even company. They had a network issue. A lot of the manufacturing in the United States has gone more regional. And so any trucking network that is a national long-haul network was under pressure. And so this new management team was like, we're going to shorten the length of haul, make this a much more dynamic network, and as we shorten the length of haul, we're going to get better rates per mile. And that just happens. As you haul freight on a shorter length of haul basis, you tend to get more per mile. And that's very accretive to margin. And so at a break-even level, you know, these guys were saying we can get, you know, a 5% operating margin, and they were at break even. So I was like, if they can get a 3% operating margin, this is going to be huge. You know, this will be very powerful to earnings. And you know, they were pretty convincing. And so I bought the story and bought the stock. And what transpired was the fact that this was a very hard thing to do. It's very hard to rejigger a truck network, as I learned. And they were not successful at doing it. And I can remember talking to the CFO, and he was like, they had a very bad quarter. And I was like, what happened? He's like, well, you know, there was a day when we didn't know where any of our trucks were because our technology system went down. I'm like, oh my gosh, like, that's really bad. And it dawned on me that these guys really didn't know what they were doing. And that's when I got out of the stock, and it definitely went down further from that level. So I think the lesson learned is you always have to do your own homework. You can't trust anybody else's, and don't always believe what you hear, because these management teams, there's so many management teams that are oddly, in a way, they love to talk up their stock, and sometimes it can cloud their sense of reality. So that's the biggest lesson. It's like, don't always believe what you hear. And you have to do a lot of your own research, or it's not worth doing an investment, you know?
Mm-hmm. 100%. So, okay, in summary then, what are the key points you'd like our audience to take away from reading your white paper?
Yeah. I would, you know, just to summarize, would say that, you know, over time it's proven that small beats large, that value beats quality. I'm sorry, that value beats growth. And quality beats junk, and those you know, don't always hold true every month, every year, but over the long run, that is a good place to allocate capital. And you know, microcaps offer an investor not only you know you can get intimate with the company, you can really understand what the company's doing. It's less efficient. You know, there is higher volatility because of the liquidity risk premium. But if you have a long-term view, I think it's a wonderful place to put some capital, you know, and I think you can have some fun with it.
So where can our audience go and find more information about DGHM and actually go to read the paper?
You can go to our website. It's www.dghm.com, and there you can find all the information on our microcap fund and our white paper.
And I'll also be sure to put a link in the description as well. So, Donald, thank you so much for joining me on the Planet Microcap podcast today. Have a great weekend, and look forward to talking soon.
Hey, it was great. Thanks.
Thank you all for tuning in to the Planet Microcap podcast, and thank you, Donald, again for coming on to the program. You can access the podcast by going on to stocknewsnow.com under podcast, go to podbean.com and search Planet Microcap podcast, or on iTunes and search Planet Microcap podcast. Stay tuned for the next Planet Microcap podcast, where we'll have our next guest to discuss all things microcap. If you have any questions or comments about the podcast, please send an email to info@stocknewsnow.com. I'd love to hear from all of you. This podcast has been brought to you by SNN Incorporated, publishers of StockNewsNow.com, the official microcap news source, and the Microcap Review magazine. I'm your host, Robert Kraft, and thank you again for joining me on the Planet Microcap podcast. Have a great week, everyone.